content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Romani Arrowsmith from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Teen Vogue magazine, Glamour magazine, and an essay collection called Men Looking at Women Looking at Men. Kind of a confusing title there. Okay, so the theme for today is hair, and our first essay is called Why I Love My Natural Hair from TeenVogue.com by Adele Jackson Gibson. So here's the lie, and that's L-Y-E, not L-I-E. You can find it right in aisle 5. It's the active ingredient of a white chemical cream that sits in mini tubs in the hair care section in your average American drugstore. Lye is good for taking the kink right out of a nappy head. It's supposed to give any black girl the long, soft tresses of the brown model smiling on the box. The process is called hair relaxing. If your tired old coils need a spring vacation, try brands like Dark and Lovely or African Pride. These products get right at the roots, and one kit costs only $6.79. Lye is also used for curing foods like pretzels and olives. It makes a good base for drain cleaners or any agent needed to dispose of large amounts of roadkill. Just ask 1939 serial killer Leonardo Cianciulli, who used the chemical to turn 3 dead bodies into soap. But I didn't know all of this when I had finally convinced my mom to let the hairdresser put this chemical goop on my scalp. And if I had known, would I have cared? I was 16, and I so desperately wanted to look like most of the girls at my prep school in Buffalo, New York. All bougie and straight-laced with their UGG boots and Vera Bradley bags. The prep school aesthetic that was more easily attainable for rich white kids. I remember the day I sat in the salon chair and my hairdresser, Vicky, sectioned my hair to slather pink gel on my scalp. She lined my forehead, the nape of my neck, and the crevice behind my ears until my whole head was sticky. The gel was for protection. "Just tell me when it's burning, and then I'll wash it out," said Vicky as she walked away to prepare my conditioning treatment. $100. When I left that salon, I could feel thin scabs forming at the tips of my ears, but I didn't tell my mom. Besides, I could roll down the car window and feel the cool wind dance the hair off my sideburns. My hair could never do that before. I've been fighting my curls since I was a little girl. Back then, my parents helped me to keep my little fro tame and neat. It was soft and broke off easily when a comb ran through it, and still it had to be detangled and braided for me to go to school. On Sundays, my two younger sisters and I would each get in the shower and calm the itchy follicles with shea butter conditioners. My mother would blow dry our hair, then tease and weave all 3 of our tender heads. It was hours of whining and crying and Looney Tunes on TV. I loved when my mom did my hair, because she was really good at making the braids all fine and thin. Afterwards, I would twirl my hair around because it could fly. But my mother was a hospital physician and was often busy with work. So sometimes my father had to take her place, and he would make these bulky plaits we all hated. It was because hardly any of our friends in private school had such a hairstyle, and it was like nothing we saw in fashion magazines. I wanted to look more like Courtney Collins in the 4th grade because she was Irish and had a lot of freckles. I still cherish the ones speckled all over my hands. Junior year in high school, my mother let me get my first relaxer. That week, I felt pretty and rather happy to take my school picture. My smile was all bright and wide. But after years of treating and frying my hair with flat irons, it became brittle and frayed at the ends. I kept cutting it short to start over again. Then one year, I had to give it all up. When I graduated from college, I accepted a job to teach English in Japan, and I knew I wouldn't be able to get my hair done the way I wanted. I had to cut it off and go natural. Weeds are natural, I thought, but that didn't mean I liked them. And doesn't everyone think they're ugly? Still, when I moved to Asagiri, Japan, I knew I didn't have to worry about my appearance. I was one of the few black people to have lived in that town, so it didn't matter how good or bad I looked. My neighbors were too busy trying to figure out what I was. When I taught second grade, I often joined the kids for lunch. I'd sit at my desk in the front of the classroom facing the kids and watch them slurp their soup in silence while I poked my fish with chopsticks. This one boy with a buzz cut liked to guzzle his milk really fast, and one day Taku finished his lunch super early. He ran to ask me this question. "Adele-sensei, can I touch your hair?" He smiled at me, with his mouth covered in milk, his hands sticky with rice. "Taku, did you wash your hands?" I said. He ran to rinse off and returned grinning. "See?" he said, as he flashed his damp palms. "Okay, you can touch." Before I knew it, all the kids lined up behind my desk. They giggled as they reached up to scrunch my hair. "It's so cool," Taku said, and his friends jumped up and down in agreement. Their grubby massages and affirmations became my new daily hair routine. They became the voice I never knew I needed. I didn't move to Japan to find myself, but here was Taku showing me the mirrors of his little beady eyes. And there I was. If he thought my hair was amazing, then why couldn't I? Maybe it was time that I realized my curls were special, albeit alien to Asagiri. I guess my hair is just out of this world. Now when I get my hair cut, I go to the barbershop down the street from my apartment in Brooklyn. $20. My barber's name is Dexter, and he's from Trinidad. When he cuts hair, he's usually bouncing to a dance hall mixtape on the boombox. I like to enjoy life, you know? He smiles and invites me to his chair. Today, I'm not nervous. This is probably the fourth time that I've come to the red carpet salon. When I sit among the guys at the shop, we often talk about workout routines and the foods we like to eat. Dexter picks up the clippers, and we decide to shape my hair into a frohawk. "She's a pretty lady, right, Daryl?" says Dexter. He nods to a guy swiveling on the chair across from us. "All natural, no artificial ingredients." Daryl grins and reveals a gold tooth. "She's an all-natural beauty," Dexter says and swivels me toward the mirror. The blood rushes to my cheeks. "Type O." For some reason, his words surprise me. But in my heart, I know. Dexter wouldn't tell a lie. Okay, this next one is from Glamour Magazine by Alicia Cara. Or it's about Alicia Cara, rather. The story is by Ben Rayner. So here's the intro to this essay, which is: Alicia Cara opens up about her struggle with hair loss. There isn't one way to look beautiful. Alicia Cara first came on our radar with her track Here, the story of a sober wallflower at a raging party. Now 20, she isn't just a pop star, she's a pop activist. Cara has pledged to always go makeup-free when she performs Scars to Your Beautiful, her anthem for anyone who's felt uncomfortable in their skin. The video features powerful cameos from, among others, cancer survivors and transgender people challenging beauty standards. We all look at ourselves in the mirror and think, "I hate this, I wish that were different," from something minor like, "I have a pimple today," to something major like, "I don't want to live anymore because I don't think I'm good enough," she says in Glamour's September issue. In Scars, I wanted to tell people, there isn't one way to look beautiful. You are beautiful, and it's the world that needs to change. Now, Cara is opening up for the first time ever about her biggest beauty battle yet and the inspiration for her hit single, her struggle with hair loss. Having a mom as a hairdresser was really awesome. I was always her test dummy. I've had every style, every color you could imagine. But I have always struggled with my hair one way or another. There were times when I just wanted to look like everyone else because people would make comments like, "Oh, your hair is so frizzy." So I started straightening my hair, and maybe that was the reason for it. In late elementary school, early high school, I started losing my hair in chunks in the shower. It was one of the scariest things. It got to the point where it was visibly gone. I struggled with that a lot, especially going into high school. You have so many pressures, what people are going to think of you, and I was going into it losing all my hair. I had, like, nothing left. It was patches of missing hair that people would point out because people are mean in high school. I was constantly looking for hairstyles to hide the bald spots, and I didn't know why it was happening. I just kept thinking, why am I so young and having to deal with this? I didn't want people to look at me. I didn't want people to get too close. Even now, I struggle with it. Sometimes you can see that my hair is missing in some spots. I've just learned how to accept it. Being in the public eye, You're always worried about what angle people are going to take pictures of you at. I don't really care anymore. I just let my hair dry naturally. I don't hide it. I want Scars to Your Beautiful to reach different types of women. The girl I am talking about, it's me. It's you. It's every girl who struggled with feeling not good enough. I want to talk about all the different extremes that girls go through to feel beautiful. I am stubborn enough to know not to change myself. I read things about my hair all the time. But I love my curls now. I always get criticized for my clothing because I like wearing jeans and t-shirts. There's nothing wrong with dressing sexy. It's just I don't want to be anything that I'm not. I'm not here to be a fashion icon. I am here to make songs. We decided that every performance I do of Scars, every interview I do about it, I'm not going to be wearing any makeup. Because how could I be preaching a song about being yourself and being beautiful and perfect the way you are and have a full face of makeup? I want to show people that I'm comfortable enough to go on national television and just be myself. It would only feel right if I'm 100% me. It's okay if you love wearing makeup. Like the Kylie lip kits, the colors are awesome. I just want to tell people there isn't only one way to look. You can be natural, you can have a full face of makeup, you can be skinny or fat or short or tall. There is no definition for beautiful. There is no right or wrong way. Just be yourself. Okay, and this next essay is from a book collection by Siri Hustvedt called A Woman Looking at Men, Looking at Women, and the specific essay is called Much Ado About Hairdos. When my daughter was in elementary school, she wore her hair long, and every night before I began reading aloud to her, I sat behind her to comb and then braid it. If left loose during her hours of hectic sleep and dreams, Sophie's hair was transformed into a great bird's nest by morning. I especially liked the braiding ritual, liked the sight of my child's ears and the back of her neck, liked the feel and look and smell of her shiny brown hair, liked the folding over and under of the three skeins of hair between my fingers. The braiding was also an act of anticipation. It came just before we crawled into her bed together, settled in among the pillows and sheets, and I began to read, and Sophie to listen. Even this simple act of plaiting my child's hair gives rise to questions about meaning. Why do more girl children wear their hair long in our culture than boy children? Why is hairstyle a sign of sexual difference? I have to admit that unless a boy child of mine had begged me for braids, I probably would have followed convention and kept his hair short, even though I think such rules are arbitrary and constricting. And finally, why would I have been mortified to send Sophie off to school with her tresses in high-flying, ratted knots? All mammals have hair. Hair is not a body part so much as a lifeless extension of a body. Although the bulb of the follicle is alive, the hair shaft is dead and insensible, which allows for its multiple manipulations. We are the only mammals who braid, knot, powder, pile up, oil, spray, tease, perm, color, curl, straighten, augment, shave off, and clip our hairs. It grows on the border between person and world. As Mary Douglas argued in Purity and Danger, substances that cross the body's boundaries are signs of disorder and may easily become pollutants. Hair attached to our heads is part of us, but hair clogged in the shower drain after a shampoo is waste. Hair protrudes from all over human skin except the soles of our feet and the palms of our hands. Contiguity plays a role in hair's significance. Hair on a person's head frames her or his face, and the face is the primary focus in most of our communicative dealings with others. We recognize people by their faces. We speak, listen, nod, and respond to a face, especially to eyes. Head hair, and more intrusively beard hair, exists at the periphery of these vital exchanges that begin immediately after birth, and once we become self-conscious, are concerned that our hair is in place, unmust, or must in just the right way, has to do with its role as messenger to the other. A never-combed head of hair may announce that its owner lives outside human society altogether, is a wild child, a hermit, or an insane person. It may also signify beliefs and political or cultural marginality. Think of the dreadlocks of Rastafarians or the long, matted hair of the sannyasis, ascetic wanderers in India. The combed-out afro, or natural, for women and men in the 1960s communicated a wordless but potent political story. As a high school student, I thought of Angela Davis's hair as a sign not only of her politics but of her formidable intellect, as if her association with Herbert Marcuse and the Frankfurt School could be divined in her commanding halo. Was the brilliant Davis a subliminal influence on my decision in the middle of the 1970s to apply a toxic permanent wave solution to my straight shoulder-length blonde hair, a chemical alteration that was literally hair-raising? The afro style, sort of, on me, not just a white girl, but an extremely white girl, turned the natural into the unnatural. I was hardly alone in adopting the look. As fashions travel from one person or group to another, their significance mutates. Note the bleached blonde hair of famous black sports stars, or the penchant for cornrows by certain white people. Despite its important role as speechless social messenger, hair is a part of the human body we can live without. Losing a head of hair, or shaving our legs and underarms, or waxing away pubic hair, is not like losing an arm or a finger. "It will always grow back," is a phrase routinely used to comfort those who have suffered a bad haircut. Hair that touches a living head, but is itself dead, has an object-like quality no other body part has, except our fingernails and toenails. Hair is at once of me and an alien it. When I touch the hair of another person, I am similarly touching him or her, but not his or her internally felt body. I remember that when my niece Juliet was a baby, she used to suck on her bottle, twirling her mother's long hair around her fingers as her eyes slowly opened and closed. It was a gesture of luxurious, soporific pleasure. Well after her bottle had been abandoned, she was unable to fall asleep without the ritual hair twiddling, which meant, of course, that the rest of my sister was forced to accompany these essential strands. Asti's hair, as part of Juliet's mother but not her mother's body proper, became what D.W. Winnicott called a transitional object, the stuffed animal, bit of blanket, lullaby, or routine many children need to pave the way to sleep. The thing or act belongs to Winnicott's intermediate area of experience, a between zone that is outside the individual but is not the external world, an object or ritual imbued with the child's longings and fantasies that helps ease her separation from her mother. Hair, as marginalia, lends itself particularly well to this transitional role. Every infant is social from birth, and without crucial interactions with an intimate caretaker, it will grow up to be severely disabled. Although the parts of the brain that control autonomic functions are quite mature at birth, emotional responses, language, and cognition develop through experience with others, and those experiences are physiologically coded in brain and body. The lullabies, head and hair stroking, rocking, cooing, playing, talk, and babble that take place between parent and baby during infancy are accompanied by synaptic brain connectivity unique to a particular individual. The cultural social is not a category beyond the physical. It becomes the physical body itself. Human perception develops through a dynamic learning process, and when perceptual, cognitive, and motor skills are learned well enough, they become automatic and unconscious, part of implicit memory. It is when automatic perceptual patterns are interrupted by a novel experience, however, that we require full consciousness to reorder our expectation, be it about hair or anything else. When Sophie went off to school with her two long, neat braids swinging behind her, she did not disturb anyone's expectations, but when the psychologist Sandra Bem sent her 4-year-old boy Jeremy off to nursery school wearing the barrettes he had requested she put in his hair, he was hounded by a boy in his class, who kept insisting that only girls wear barrettes. Jeremy sensibly replied that barrettes don't matter. He had a penis, and this fact made him a boy, not a girl. His classmate, however, remained unconvinced, and in a moment of exasperation, Jeremy pulled down his pants to give proof of his boyhood. After a quick glance, his comrade said, "Everybody has a penis. Only girls wear barrettes." Most boys in contemporary Western culture begin to resist objects, colors, and hairdos coded as feminine as soon as they have become certain of their sexual identity, around the age of 3. Jeremy's fellow pupil seemed to have been muddled about genitalia, but adamant about social convention. In this context, the barrette metamorphosed from innocuous hair implement into an object of gender subversion. The philosopher Judith Butler would call Jeremy's barrette wearing a kind of performativity. Gender is doing, not being. Girls have more leeway to explore masculine forms than boys have to explore feminine forms. Unlike barrettes on a boy, short hair on a girl is not subject to ridicule, noteworthy because the feminine has far more polluting power for a boy in our culture than the masculine has for a girl. During the 3 or 4 years before she reached puberty, another niece of mine, Ava, had a short haircut and was sometimes identified as a boy. One year, she played with gender performance in the costume she chose for Halloween. Half of her went as a girl, the other half as a boy. Hair was a vital element in this down-the-middle disguise. The long, flowing locks of a wig adorned the girl half. Her own short hair served the boy half. I began the 5th grade with long hair, but at some point in the middle of the year, I chopped it into what was then called a pixie cut. When I returned to school newly shorn, I was informed that the boy I liked, a boy who had supposedly liked me back, had withdrawn his affection. It had been swept away and discarded at the hairdresser's along with my silky locks. I recall thinking that my former admirer was a superficial twit, but perhaps he had succumbed to a Goldilocks fantasy. He would not be the last male person in my life to fixate on feminine blondeness and its myriad associations in our culture, including abstract qualities such as purity, innocence, stupidity, childishness, and sexual allure embodied by multiple figures, the goddesses Sif, Freya, and the Valkyries of Norse mythology, the multitudes of fair maidens in fairy tales, numerous heroines in Victorian novels and melodramas, and cinematic bombshells such as Harlow and Monroe, both of whom I love to watch on screen. The infantile and dumb connotations of blonde may explain why I have often dreamed of a buzz cut. The fairy tale and mythological creatures so dear to me as a child may explain why I have had short hair as an adult, but never that short, and did not turn myself into a brunette or redhead. A part of me must hesitate to shear myself of all blonde feminine meanings, as if next to no hair would mean severing a connection to an earlier self. Iris, the narrator of my first novel, The Blindfold, crops her hair during a period in her life of defensive transformation. She wanders around New York City after dark, wearing a man's suit. She gives herself the name of a sadistic boy in a German novel she has translated. Klaus. The gap between what I was forced to acknowledge to the world, namely that I was a woman, and what I dreamed inwardly, didn't bother me. By becoming Klaus at night, I had effectively blurred my gender. The suit, my clipped head and unadorned face altered the world's view of who I was, and I became someone else through its eyes. I even spoke differently as Klaus. I was less hesitant, used more slang, and favored colorful verbs. My heroine's butch haircut partakes of her second act of translation, from feminine Iris to masculine Klaus, a performance that belies the notion that appearance is purely superficial. By playing with her hair and clothes, she subverts cultural expectations that have shaped her in ways she finds demeaning. Short hair or long? Interpretations of length change with time and place. The Merovingian kings, circa 457 to 750, wore their hair long as a sign of their high status. Samson's strength famously resided in his hair. The composer Franz Liszt's shoulder-length hair became the object of frenzied, fetishistic female desire. The mini-narratives of television commercials for formulas to cure male baldness reinforce the notion that the fluff above is linked to action below. Once a man's hair has been miraculously restored, a seductive woman inevitably appears beside him on the screen to caress his newly sprouted locks. But then, shampoo commercials for women also contain sexual messages that long, and sometimes short, frequently wind-blown tresses will enchant a dream man. Okay, we're almost out of time, so I'm just going to read an excerpt of this next story about model Ducky Thought on Embracing Her Natural Hair from teenvogue.com by Janelle Hickman. After years of being instructed how to look, feel, and even act, 21-year-old model Nayadak Ducky Thought is embracing her inner voice. So Teen Vogue asks the question, you recently spoke up on social media about being hesitant to appear on set with your natural hair, and you also wrote about a painful experience you had on Australia's Next Top Model. Ducky had to cornrow hair herself during one of the challenges due to an inexperienced hairstylist. How did you feel, and how did you bounce back after that? Ducky, that experience definitely didn't make me feel confident. I felt like a joke during that whole scene, to be honest, and I felt like that many other times during the show. I got a lot of backlash on social media for my weight gain, the color of my skin, and my hair. So I took quite a few blows as a 17-year-old girl, and it was hard to understand why. I was lucky enough to have a mentor who understood what I was going through. Her name is Charlotte Dawson, and she had her own online battle with negative comments on social media, which unfortunately she took her own life over. But no matter what she was personally going through, she always made the effort in time to make sure I was okay. She called me after every episode. She spoke out for me during interviews. She went the extra mile every time for me. That was really my driving force post-show. Teen Vogue says, you've mentioned you often wear wigs and extensions on shoots or casting calls. How does this affect your relationship with your natural hair? Ducky, first and foremost, hair is an accessory and doesn't define a woman. I've done all things possible with my hair for the industry. I've been skin bald, shaved, cut with blonde hair. I've been fairy floss pink. I've tried and done everything possible for other people. What I've learned from all of this is that you need to step in being your complete self. If that means walking up to a casting agent with a 24-inch Brazilian weave down to my butt, then so be it. I feel good, I feel sexy, and I feel confident. With that being said, with natural hair becoming more socially acceptable, I think people often forget that wigs, weaves, and extensions are a part of and come from Black culture too. In my field especially, growing up and trying to work in Australia, no one really went out of their way to help me. I remember doing absolutely everything they asked of me. I'd still end up with bald patches on my head or looking pasty or ashy in the face on the photos. Being a Black woman, we haven't really been taught how to take care of our natural hair. We've only been taught how to hide it. So this article has been edited for time because we are out of time for today. Be sure to listen next time. And we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Romani Arrowsmith, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.